you older people here know, I worked a lot on topology about 30 years ago, and then left it to study kind of analysis questions, and I've recently been doing topology again, so it's really nice being back. And it's nice to be here at this conference for Jack. So let's start with, I want to make a sort of a transition from the, a little bit of a transition from the free loop space of a manifold to what the physicists call the sigma model, although I'm not going to use any terminology or concepts or facts or intuitions or from physics except that one word right there. And sigma, as this came up yesterday, why do they call it the sigma model? I think it's just sigma is the name of a Riemann surface, and you usually consider all maps of Riemann surfaces into some target. I think that's so. So first, let's consider a surface with boundary. If we consider all maps of this into M, I'm going to use that symbol for like all maps. Then, of course, being topologists, we know since you actually have boundary, this is can be contracted down to the one skeleton, so it's a graph, connected graph mapping in. So as far as the algebraic topology of this space is concerned, we can think of this as a map of a graph in, and then a graph, connected graph, is the same as a up to homotopy type of bouquet of spheres. So this is really the up to homotopy, and it's the same as this. So, you know, if we, and on the other hand, if we just had one of these, that would be the free loop space, L of M. And the free loop space has two structures that are kind of significant and different. One is it's a groupoid, so it admits a mapping to, evaluation mapping to M and various evaluation mappings to various products, but, and the fiber of the map is the base loop space, which is a group. So it's a family of groups. So that's one of its structures. And then the other structure is that it has this circle action. So it has these two structures, kind of the groupoid structure, which is embodied in all the properties of this map, and also it has an S1 action. And now, if you using this groupoid structure, you can take products, and then you would have, and then you can look at, you'd have a product vibration. You could restrict it to the diagonal, and then you would have, like maps of, you would have this. So if you had k loops, but under the evaluation they all went to the same point, then you would have this. So really, this mapping space of surfaces with boundary is, so to speak, part of the structure of the loop space, I would say. It's naturally evolving from the loop space. So this object here could be thought of as a something closely related to the, if you're really studying the free loop space systematically, you might consider this as part of the study. For example, you know, a single loop would like be replaced by a map of an annulus into the M, and a bouquet of two circles, for example, could be thought of as like this. So since we have all these maps of, so we're naturally led to consider all of these function spaces, which starts looking like the sigma model. This is, let's call this thing sigma. We're looking at maps of sigma into M. Now let's just go ahead and also consider, let's let sigma be any surface with boundary, and then now let's also consider closed surfaces. So now, So let's think of all maps of sigma into M, where sigma is any surface with or without boundary. And then I want to sort of say what I mean. So what I mean by string topology. So again, there's a little bit of connection. When the physicists make certain constructions out of this thing, they get examples of what they call string theory. So again, it's consistent with what I'm about to say now. So by string topology in this talk, I want to mean it's equivariant structure in the algebraic topology of these maps. So let's take some kind of direct sum over all isomorphism classes of surfaces with respect to the action of diff sigma and cross diff M. So this is what I think is a kind of a reasonable definition. So structure in the algebraic topology of these mapping spaces, but which is somehow equivariant. So what it means is, intuitively, is that you have this manifold, and then you have this map of the surface in there, and somehow you have to look at the picture of the map, and then do something with the picture, and of the image, and that'll be invariant under diffeomorphisms of the domain, because by definition you're looking at the image, and also if it's a sort of intrinsic property of the picture, it'll be invariant under diffeomorphisms of M as well. So that's the motivation for saying it that way. I'm not going to say anything about this aspect of it today, although I think it's an important aspect. One reason we don't say something about it in general is that, you know, we usually don't know very much about what this is, whereas we know a lot about this. So it's, you know, studying this from the point of view of algebraic topology is equivalent to studying the modular group. Not exactly. For the case of the annulus, it's equivalent to studying the circle, and for the case of the two-sphere, it's equivalent to studying SO3. But for all the other ones, it's equivalent to studying some kind of modular group, and the torus too, I guess. Except for a few exceptions, it's equivalent to studying the discrete group. So this is, we know what to do here, but we usually don't know what to do there. But still, the structure is invariant under that, and that's important. So an example of this is the theorem mentioned in Poe's talk, is that the homology of the loop space of M is a BV algebra. And let me just write the equation for that. So what it means is that there's a ring structure, which I'm going to discuss in a general way in a minute. And then there's this operator delta, which is coming from the circle action. The ring structure uses the groupoid aspect, and the delta uses the circle action. It sort of is the circle action. And then there's this equation that delta of A times B is delta of A times B plus minus 1 to the A times delta of B, and delta squared is 0. So this is the definition of a BV algebra. Oh, I forgot the other term. Where this is a Lie bracket. So there's a Lie bracket on the homology, and there's this operator of square 0. And they're all related like that. Okay, that's what a BV algebra is. Okay, so how do we start? Oh, so let me just say little examples. So intuitively, you somehow look at the map. So for example, you could look at, if you have this map sigma, you could look, for example, at the derivative of the map, and you could study where it degenerates, where the rank drops by 1 and by 2. So you can kind of look at the singularities of the map, where it's not an immersion. So you can look at that, and you can also look at coincidences, where the map, you know, cuts through itself, or whether if this thing had two components, where the two components would cross. So basically, these things would be invariant with respect to this group. Okay, so how can we start systematically saying some of these structures? So, so I have a remark now. It's sort of a useful remark. I'm going to take the sort of geometric covariant viewpoint for studying algebraic topology. There's also the algebraic contravariant viewpoint, where you map out from the space you're studying. I'm going to be mapping into the space I'm studying, and namely into this function space. So I'm going to talk about cycles and homologies in this space. So I'm going to be talking about cycles and homologies in a geometric way, cycles and homologies. So abstract cycles, abstract homologies. These are a cycle is a generalization of a closed oriented manifold, and a homology is a generalization of a manifold with boundary. And in some sense, these are easier to define than a manifold, but psychologically, everybody knows what a manifold is, so it seems like these are harder to define. These are somehow like manifolds with singularities, geometrically. So anyway, the remark is, suppose you have a G space X. Suppose a group G acts on X. Then you want to talk about a cycle or a homology, an equivariant cycle or an equivariant homology for this G space. Then just make a remark about what that is. So what this is you have to have is a base, which is a cycle or a homology. A homology is like a generalized manifold boundary. So you have a base, and then you have a vibration over the base, where it's an X vibration with structure group G. So this is X, and then you should have a cross section of this vibration. So that's just the remark is this is the same thing as a cycle or a homology in the Borel construction associated to the group action. Because if you have a map into the Borel construction, that fibers over BG, so that gives you this bundle, and then having the lift is this cross section. So this is just a tautology. But it's sort of a geometric thing you can look at. So in our case, so when you're discussing equivariant, say, algebraic topology from the point of view of mapping geometric objects in, then you have to look at these things. So now what's our space X is the maps from sigma into M. So, but the group is acting like this. You know, this group is acting here, and this group is acting here. So we can actually split it up. So we can think that an element, a covariant geometric object in the algebraic topology of this, equivariant algebraic topology of this, is a some base, which is a cycle or homology. And then over, and then we have a, over each point we have a point in this, a varying point in this thing. So it looks like what we have is a, first of all we would have a bundle of surfaces. We'd have a surface bundle for every point. And then we would also have a bundle with fiber M, and then we would have this cross section, which would be a map. So then we would have a map of every fiber. So we'd have like a family of maps of a moving abstract surface into an abstract copy of M. That would be a equivariant homology class. And then we could look at some of these geometric properties. So there. Okay. Now I want to actually. So let me draw a little better picture of the fiber. So now I'm going to kind of suppress these parameters here, but that's the formal thing. So I think of the. And the map, I mean, kind of suppress it. Maybe just draw the surface. Now, also, I want to augment the picture a little bit by adding, having marked points. So I want to have boundary marked points at this. And so it's sigma decorated with possibly with some marked points. And then this diffeomorphism sigma has to preserve the decoration. What? Well, of the mapping space, yeah. Now, that's what I said. For any space, this is a picture of an equivariant thing. Now I'm going to take this group and this space to be, this is X, mapping space, and this is the group. Well, I can if I want to. No, that was, I tried to make this transition up here. We start from the loose space, think of map of an annulus instead of a loop, and then, you know, the discussion of string topology that the original one with this naturally had these pictures in it anyway. So just go ahead and start from those pictures. And then, in a way, it fits with the idea of the sigma model, at least in language, and so we're getting closer. And then at the end, I'm going to try to get to the... application to Gromov-Witten, which is a, you know, what is a mathematical theory, but the physicists call it a topological string theory. I started recopying my notes over, and I stopped in the middle. The problem here. Oh yeah. Okay. We'll look at that again, I hope. Okay. Okay, so there are five pictures. There are sort of five ways to glue surfaces with boundary together. Let me not have to think. I don't seem to be thinking very well right now. So there are five ways. So if you have this marked point, you can sort of glue these two points together, or actually glue together little intervals around the boundary. Let's just do it like that. So you can add it down here like this. So there's that operation. There's you could have two boundary components and then put a strip between like that. And then you could also do the obvious thing where you have two separate things and then I'll call these, say A, B, and C. And then these are going to fit with string topology, the way it's normally discussed. And then this is a slight extension of the terminology. We have two more for closed surfaces, or it's actually, they don't have to be closed, but there's interior operations. You have 2 points, and you can cut a small disk out here, and you can do this operation, and then you can also do this operation. So these are things you do with these marked points. So the idea is that whenever you, so this is a familiar idea, but it's always the same idea, but let me sort of say it. So you have one of these equivariant families of maps, so, and you have marked points. Suppose you want to do one of these five gluing operations on this cycle. Well, you added this new piece in each case, and you need to know how to map that. And if you don't have any information about how to map that, then you're going to map it to a point. Or so you need that the 2 points that you're gluing together at least be close together, or say coincide, or be close together. So then this piece that you add, you can map to a neighborhood of that point. So for example, you may have some kind of thing with boundary, and it actually, the boundary has a coincidence, and so then you can glue in this little piece there and then map it to that point. So anytime you have coincidences in the map corresponding to these points coinciding in the map, then you can do these operations, and then you're sort of get an operation in this space, and because of the nature of the operation, it's equivariant with respect to diffeomorphism of the domain and diffeomorphism of the range. So how do you do that? Well, I'm imagining, so you're in this picture, you have an equivariant homology. So here's your abstract homology, and then you have a fiber over it, so it might be one of these, it might be a disconnected thing, and then you have these marked points, and say you want to, and they're labeled. Suppose you want to glue this point to this point, according to that picture over there. Well, then you look in the base at those maps where these 2 points coincide. So that'll be a locus, sort of locus IJ. So that's where these 2 points that you want to glue coincide. So over those things, you're going to see a drawing like this. And then just over the locus, the image looks like that. And then you can perform this little operation here. And now, I'll be a little more precise about how I perform this operation, because I want this to be an operation at the chain level, So for example, when I do, so there's a little discussion for these three, and then one discussion for these three, for these two. So the way I do, say this one, is I have these two pieces I want to glue together, and I know that there's a coincidence at these two points, say a transversal coincidence. Since it's transversal, it would go, say this is, suppose this is the actual boundary, it would actually, it would look like this. It would have boundary in the boundary. It might have a cycle part. Then what you do is you blow up, you take the direction blow up there, and so you really create a little thing like this. And then you choose a metric on this so that it has fixed length, a metric on this so that it has fixed length, and then you take an isometric gluing. And then you map this arc that you've blown up, you map it right back to the point. So you use the same map that you had before, and you do that. And I claim that that's well-defined up to diffeomorphism of the domain. So it's well-defined. This choice of metric is well-defined up to diffeomorphism. So in this I forgot to say the equivalence relation. When you, two of these objects are going to be equivalent, if there's a orientation preserving diffeomorphism here, bundle isomorphism here that carries the section to the selection, exactly. So if you use that, these are, so this, the chain complex I'm going to use is going to be the free module over Q, the free rational vector space, the rational vector space generated by the equivalence classes. This step here, putting this arrow down here, which is not the identity, forces you to go to the rationals. It's also crucial for what I'm doing. If anybody wants to know about what that means, I can talk to them afterwards. So this is, everything now is going to be with rational coefficients because of this equivalence relation here. Now that's how you do these three, and then this one, you do the same thing. If you have two points, you want to do this operation. You do the direction blow up at these two points. That creates a little circle here and here, and then you choose a metric and a metric here that makes the length one, and then you choose. Oh, and now you get an orientation. Yeah, there's an orientation induced here. So you have to do, there are two ways to glue an interval to an interval. You do it to respect the orientation. Here there's an induced orientation. Everything is oriented. Everything is oriented. Oriented. And there's an induced orientation on each circle. And so you choose an orientation reversing isometry between these two circles. And then you do the gluing that way. So you don't really draw this. This thing is really the picture of the orientation reversing isometry. And then you map this circle back to the, so you really have these two surfaces crossing, and you're just taking them apart, and you're blowing up and then gluing together. And then you map this circle that you create back to here. Now somebody should ask a question now. Huh? That's the question. Yeah, so what orientation reversing isometry do I choose? There's a circle of them. So I'm working on the chain level. So actually what it is over the locus where you have this coincidence, there's a natural circle bundle. It's a circle bundle defined over the locus, which is, well, it's actually defined over the whole thing. It's the orientation reversing isometries between this circle and this circle. It's actually defined over the whole thing, but in particular, it's defined on the locus. And so this is going to be this circle bundle is going to be the base of the output. So for each point on this circle, I can do the operation. And then I get a glued up surface. So these operations here have degree minus d, where d is the dimension of m, because the coincidence is k is d constraints. And these operations here have degree minus d plus 1 because of this circle bundle. Now, this is something, and then there's another sort of, actually, I need an orientation of this circle. And that's a sort of fundamental point in this Gromov-Witten theory and compact five moduli space and all that. See, we're doing all this twist, so there's in a sense, there's a circle of Riemann surfaces you get. For each point here, you get a twisted surface. So what it is, it's a Dehn-Twist family of construction. In other words, you have this, let's say we're coming into the hole, and then we do all possible twists. And so we have a circle bundle of Riemann surfaces. We have this Dehn-Twist. And you orient this circle. Now, if you have a twist to the right, say, it looks like a twist to the right even from this side. This is something I learned from Thurston. If you do a right earthquake, things move like this, but from this side it also looks like a right earthquake. So this circle is oriented so that this bundle over the circle has monodromy, the right Dehn twist. So that when you go around the circle, the monodromy is the right Dehn twist. Okay? It's like a fundamental point. So we need an orientation of this. We have an orientation here by transversality. We don't quite have it. I need another assumption here for this structure here. I'm going to give this detail for the rest of the talk, but the detail is more elaborate for A, B, and C. I'm going to suppose that D is even. When D is even, when you look at M cross M, the normal bundle has an orientation that's independent of the order of factors. If you orient the manifold, the normal bundle, the diagonal, has an orientation that's independent of the flip of factors when D is even. So this locus here gets a natural orientation by pulling back the normal bundle of the diagonal. That's how you create the coincidence. And this object is oriented, so therefore this object is oriented. And then the circle bundle is oriented by this right Dehn twist remark. So those are some points about the orientation. There's a lot of hanky-panky going on about orientations in this other case that actually people who are writing papers don't check. But and you don't really have to check it because you're just defining an operation up to signs. Who cares about sign? But if you're going to prove an identity, for example, like this one, if you're actually going to prove an identity like that, then you have to sign because you're adding things. The identity were something like A equals B, you can say it's true up to sign. But so these signs are more than just a technical point. They're a structural point of some interest. Anyway. So to get it to work out the way I want, D is now even, at least for this part. And I'm really going to discuss in detail the ABC. So the claim is that, so this idea of using transversality to create the locus where the coincidence happens is a chain operation. So the chain operation goes from this to this. This is the operation. From this family with one kind of topological structure, you get this family with another kind of topological structure and a map. So this is the operation. This is some kind of chain operation. So it's in the algebraic topology. And so a little more formally, what is it? Is that, so what I'm saying is if you have these things with marked points, then for every pair of indices, either on the boundary or in the interior, you have these gluing operations corresponding to these three kinds of things here and these two kinds of things here. And I'll go ahead, even though you don't have to in this case, I'll go ahead and forget these mark points. So you lose two mark points. Every time you do one of these operations, you lose two mark points. If you don't have any mark points, at the moment, you don't have any operations. You got a shot at me. I can't hear.
Why do you lose two marks? Is it when
they... I want to. I'm going to let it go. I'm not going to keep them. I could keep them for the first three. No, but because of what I'm going to say now, I let them go. And see, in this context, you don't really lose any information in the overall story because, for example, if you wanted to keep the mark points, what you could do is this. For example, if you wanted to keep one, like you just said, what you do is you have A, B, and then a dummy, which is a map of a disk, in family of maps of a disk. You could take like the identity map of the manifold. That's homotopy. This is just a point in the manifold, a disk, up to, for an algebraic topologist, right? So you can think of a perturbation of the identity, and then you do the operation here, and you do the operation here, and then this is your mark point. And topologically, that'll be correct. So see, if you keep, since you have all this freedom of having different components and stuff, you have that anyway, even if you didn't. And then it fits with the formalism of what I wanted to say next, of a modular operad. So the little result that this gives is that, so it's just sort of applying the old idea, but sort of in this sort of easy and natural general setting, is that we have this, in the algebraic topology of this, we have I just call this thing sigma. All these maps with this group action, just call that sigma. In the algebraic topology, we have the algebraic structure of a modular operad. So in fact, we have two of them. We have the boundary version, and we have the what you might call the bulk or interior version. So these two things, so a modular operad means you have some chain complexes associated to a finite set of mark points. And then you have operations given two of them to the thing associated to the finite set with the two points removed. That's the so they're exactly so these two is the self gluing, and this is the crosswise gluing. And then these two are the, here's the self-gluing, and here's the bulk version. And so this is just structure that's there. So this uses the operations A, B, and C, and this uses D and E. So this structure, this is just a remark. So if you just take this structure and you just manipulate it without doing any geometry again, in other words, without doing any more transversality, but you just do algebraic manipulation to it. This includes everything that I know about string topology. So all the structures that I know can be somehow gotten out of this by just formal manipulation. So let me show one of these formal manipulations now. Not quite so formal. Okay, for the rest of the talk, I want to, I mentioned derivative before. These derivatives come up, they're going to come up now. They don't really come up in here, but when you sort of try to manipulate it, the derivatives come up in terms of the calculation. So now I want to define another BV operator, delta. So in this equivariant algebra trolley. So now I have no marked points. So now I have no marked points. Or you could have it with marked points, and then you would be adding additional marked points. Let's say there are no marked points. And let's say I have possibly disconnected surface. And now I'm going to concentrate on the closed case and hope I get to the end. So you have a family of maps, say, of a disconnected surface like that into your, parameterized by some homology or cycle, mapping into some moving copy of M. Let's suppress this part, too, if you want to. That doesn't really matter. And now I want to do all possible gluing operations. So I'm going to put a pair of marked points in all possible positions. So, for example, I put one here and one here, but in all possible positions. So this is two more parameters. This is two more parameters. So this is a plus four chain operation. So if I have a base, I'm adding four more parameters to the base, which are the positions of these points. And then in that enlarged base, I look at where you have coincidences, and then I do the operation. So that's minus D plus 1. So I get a gluing operation with this dimension. So I add four extra parameters, intersect to get the coincidence, and then do the twisting to give the 1. So I get a gluing operation with that degree. So an I chain, a family gets cut down by this amount. But all possible positions. So I also want to do it here. I want to put two there, and also two here. So I want to put every pair of points. And so now, I do it. But now, see, this is a non-compact configuration space. Pairs of points here. So, but let's just work on this non-compact space for a second. So I add four more parameters. Do the intersection and do one, the twisting. But now I started from a nice compact homology. If I just did it this way, I would get a non-compact homology because the four parameters I added are in a non-compact space. There's two distinct pairs of points. So what you do is, you sort of study it a little bit. What happens when you have a coincidence that where the two points come closer and closer together, then if you have a map of a surface, you have two points, and they both map to the same thing in the manifold. If you draw the line between them, the line will have to go like that under the map. And then as these points shrink down, what you get is a little cusp in the map. And so you see that the derivative drops rank at the limit point. So by looking at the transversal locus where the derivative drops rank by 1, you can sort of fill in the operation. Turns out that's still not compact. You have to, because the derivative can drop rank by 2, and you have to look at where the rank drops by 2 as well. So you start where the rank drops by 2, then you go let the rank come up by 1, and anyway, by studying that a little bit, you can complete the operation in this case. Anyway, this creates an interesting fact. So we still have this operation. Now, before, like if I restricted my pairs to be like that, there's no non-compactness issue, and everything is beautiful. I just do transversality. And these operations, I didn't say it, but all the operations that I've defined up to now commute with the boundary operator. What is the boundary operator? I mean, if I have a family over a manifold boundary, I'd restrict the family to the boundary. That's, they get a family over the boundary. That's the boundary operator. It's like doing singular homology. And all the operations, because of transversality, when you do transversality, they go over to the boundary, and you just get, you know, the structure on the boundary is the boundary of the structure in the interior, so it's commute with the boundary. Now, but now for this operation where I have two points like this, I'm creating some extra boundary, and so I call this an anomaly. So there's an extra term. So in other words, in the picture is something like this. You can imagine here's a geometric thing you might be looking at in a map where it crosses itself, and this is like in a family of, and you see this thing shrinks to zero, and then there's nothing more. This is interior boundary in the construction. So it's an extra term in the boundary. So anomaly is this is another kind of example I said. Well, I'm not going to use any physics terms, but it's really a good term. An anomaly is like an unexpected term in the boundary of an operation. You want it to commute with the boundary, but it doesn't. So you can just, one can describe what the commutator is. You can just put this into the algebra.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want them to be distinct to do the gluing. Because I really am doing the gluing. Yeah. So there is an extra boundary. But in a sense, it's something kind of explicit geometrically. In the boundary theory, this anomaly came up before in another paper with Chass, in defining the Lebye algebra. We got rid of it by passing to a reduced group, because when you do the gluing, it's like a disconnected component, so you can sort of set this component zero. I mean, you can pass to the subcomplex. So there's a natural subcomplex that gets rid of that extra boundary term. But here, notwithstanding the fact that the last paper I wrote you did something like this, that's now in the garbage can. There's a new version of this discussion of the anomaly. I sort of retrenched and just wrote what was true, not what I wanted to be true. And actually, it's good. I think the anomaly suggests how to treat correctly the, you know, when you do it correctly, you're led along the right path, right? Anyway, so it's not just a free ride to massage this information, but in a sense, it's like it's forced on you just by continuity. It's a calculation of what's there. Now, but let me show why this is a BV operator. This is the nice thing. If we write this equation again, I'll tell you, dot now doesn't. This is not the same BV operator that was referred to up here and in the talk by Poe. This is another operation, and this dot has another meaning as well, but let me just write the equation. I haven't said what any of this means yet, but so it turns out this is just going to be disjoint union and Cartesian product. If you have an A family and a B family, you take the Cartesian product of the bases and the union of the fibers and the union of the maps. That's the natural product structure, sort of disjoint union of maps with parameters. And so then, so I'm going to draw, suppose I have two components. Then this delta means do all gluing, pairwise gluing. So we have to do all, so this sort of, we can glue like this, we could also glue like that, and we can glue like that. So this is really the sum. You have to do, it's like a sum of all these possibilities. So this term here, gluing like that, this is delta of A times B. And this term here, see, this is A and this is B. This is A and this is B. This is A and this is B. So here's delta of A times B, and this is A times delta of B. And then the other one is this. So this is the proof of the BV. This is the background proof of the fact that you have a BV algebra. So you have to check that. Oh, and delta delta is zero is also true as well. And the basic reason for that is that when you, this is an important point too, why is delta delta zero? So if you do delta twice, you sort of have two places you're gluing. And so the locus for delta is where two pairs coincide. And there's a circle associated to each one of these operations. And the orientation depends on the circle. So if you do this pair first, you use this orientation first. If you do this and then this, and if you do this pair first and then this, so the two circles which appear in the cycle occur in different orders. So they cancel. It's the usual proof that delta squared is zero that we always see in topology. But for that to be true, it turns out the chain that represents delta delta, it has an involution that interchanges the order of these two things. And so this equivalence relation that I mentioned, so there's an orientation reversing equivalence. And then this shows that the delta delta object is equivalent to minus itself. And since I'm in coefficients in Q, it's identically zero. So that's where you get delta delta zero at the chain level. So that's what forced me to go to Q coefficients, that proof. And then the delta delta zero automatically implies that this residual term here satisfies the Jacobi identity and the Leibniz rule with respect to this product. No. It obviously satisfies, this operation obviously satisfies the Leibniz rule with respect to the product. Delta delta zero then means that it also satisfies Jacobi. So this is a structure that's derived from this thing. Okay, so now in the last 5 minutes, let me make the discuss the so the string topology is not a like a it's sort of a background this way I'm defining it. It's a background algebraic structure where you have like this BV algebra. Oh, there's one quick thing I want to say here. These operations are only partially defined. They're only defined on the transversal, on chains where the things you want to do, the coincidences happen transversely. So only partially defined. And when you look at the properties of that subcomplex where they're partially defined, it's actually it has the same homology as the full complex, and it has lots of other properties with respect to tensor products and so on. And my student Scott Wilson is just finishing this year, building on the work of Kreese and May in a semi-simplicial complex, shows that when you have such partially defined operations on these apple domains, then there's an equivalent model for the algebraic topology where the operations are fully defined in characteristic zero, if you're doing characteristic zero. If you want to work over Z in this theorem, you have to do something about saying free over the symmetric group. So the fact that these are defined by transversality and that, you know, there's this very simple idea why this subcomplex has the right homology. It's just that any cycle can be moved slightly to be in general position with respect to any of these considerations. Any homology between general position cycles is in general position near the boundary, and it can be moved slightly in the interior to be in general position in the interior. And so you have a very good proof of a quasi-isomorphism, very easy. This is the proof, old proof. And so then you actually get statements at the chain level, which, as we know from rational homotopy theory and Mandel's work in integral homotopy theory, having the ring structure in cohomology at the chain level expressed appropriately gives you, in the rational homotopy type, gives you the full information about the rational homotopy type, and in the integral homotopy type gives you the full information about the integral homotopy type. So having this information at the chain level is potentially a lot more than having it at the homology level. Although I don't have any applications of that, I know it in my soul that's true. So now let's quickly say the. So now let's assume that M of even dimension D is actually a closed symplectic manifold. Up to now, we didn't use the fact the manifold is smooth and oriented. It doesn't have to be closed. It doesn't have to be compact. All these operations are defined without assuming any of that. But now let's suppose it's closed and symplectic. That remark I made to Ralph works better when it's closed, but you can modify it when it's not. That doesn't matter. Huh? Yeah. That works better when it's closed, but it still works if you say it right. You have to think kind of correctly. It's okay. It's naively right when it's closed. Now let's take closed symplectic manifold, and then in a symplectic manifold, you can add an almost complex structure J, and you can consider the subspace, the subset of maps sigma into M, which where the tangent, the DF, which are, let's say, you enrich the family. See, this diff sigma is really, as we've heard before, is really equivalent to knowing the moduli space of Riemann surfaces. So a family of surfaces is really can be enriched up to contractible choices to a family of Riemann surfaces. A family of smooth surfaces up to contractible choices is the same as a family of Riemann surfaces. So you can now think that they're all Riemann surfaces, and then you can think, well, I want to look at those that are where the map N commutes with J. Those are called J holomorphic. And then Gromov discussed these J holomorphic curves and proved a compactness result, and basically showed that that what can happen. I'm doing closed ones now. What can happen, the way they can become non-compact is just three pictures. You can have something. You can have this happening, the usual way in which, or you can have this or this. Let's say if you have a connected one. I'll say a little bit better now. Surface of genus 2. So, in other words, when you look at all the J holomorphic curves of a given genus, and maybe you want to have some mark points, which I'm not going to write down, let's say none, and you have homology class beta. So we're looking at all the surfaces. The H2 is roughly the space of components here, roughly speaking. But that's not literally correct. It's trying to be the space of components, the second homology. But anyway, so this is an element in the second homology. And so Gromov's result is that if you consider all the J holomorphic curves in one homology class, just as a set with the natural topology on the mapping space, then it's compactified by adding the limits of these drawings here. So this is pinched down to a point, this is pinched down to a point, and this is pinched down to a point. So let me state the theorem, and I'll just indicate the proof right there. Well, I should say that when you have this algebraic structure, there's something, there's an interesting equation you can write down, which is, I'm writing it in a form due to Swieback. Swieback form, which is, you can look at for boundary x equals delta x plus, let's say, 1/2 x bracket x. Now, you may wonder, this has degree minus 1, this has degree minus d plus 5, and blah, 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 blah. So it turns out there's a dimension shift by d minus 6 times, give me 2 more minutes to finish the statement. I'm going over. There's a dimension shift by C of beta is any linear function of the second homology class. G is the genus. D is the dimension of the manifold. D is even, and I want to suppose this is even. If you shift by this number, every one of the groups, see, all these groups depend on, you know, they're direct sums depending on the genus and so on. And N is the number of mark, plus 2N if you have mark points. If you shift by this, it's sort of a neat little, I invite you to do this computation, that all of these operations get degree minus 1. This is the sort of unique formula that make these operations have degree minus 1. And this, an internal shift in a complex doesn't change delta having degree minus 1. This is an internal operation. So all of these things now have degree minus 1. And so this is a natural equation that you can write down in this algebraic structure that physicists look at. And then the theorem is that let X be the perturbed Gromov homology or chain of the Gromov chain of perturbed. I don't mean this as disturbed. Well, sort of disturbed geometrically, but perturbed geometrically, J holomorphic curves. And cut off. So what do I mean by that? So what I mean by that is, we don't want to leave our space and add these ideal points. So we put in an inequality that says the complex structure on the Riemann surface cannot develop next longer than so much or smaller than so much. And this picture in the image corresponds in the domain is that there's a little point in the manifold where there's a lot of energy of the map concentrated near that point, and then it swells up like a frog's neck, you know, give a bubble like that. So you put inequalities on the complex structure and on the energy of the local energy of the map, so this doesn't happen. And that just makes, another way to state his theorem is that just makes the space compact. But now you've created boundary. So now you get a compact, it's compact now, but it's not really a chain in algebraic topology, it's just a set. So then you think of the J holomorphic equation as being, there's an infinite dimensional bundle where you compute the D bar of the map, and then you want to look at, you have your all your maps and you have D bar of the map. You're looking at the zero section of that, but this may not be transversal. So you perturb the equation so that the cross section that you're looking at is transversal. So it's still close to being J holomorphic, but just perturbed. You create transversality by the perturbation. So again, we're using transversality again. And then you now have the structure, now the equation gives the structure of a chain. And by the way, it turns out to be exactly this dimension where this is C of beta is 2C1 of beta. So it's even. This is the dimension of the locus that you get here. So you can compute the dimension of the moduli space just from algebraic topology by a grading consideration looking at these operations. And then I claim X equals satisfies star, and the proof is right here, because this is the cutoff chain. I should write this everywhere. So you see, we've cut the chain off. We've made it have boundary, but the boundary, well, it'll be stratified. The top dimensional pieces of the boundary will correspond to one degeneration like this. You can also have bubbles on bubbles, but this would be lower codimension. If you're just computing the homological boundary, then you see what we really need to do is, and there's some homology class. You have to have a non-zero homology class to support this two-sphere. So what this term of the boundary corresponds to is looking at maps of spheres in this homology class beta prime for this part. There'll be some other one, beta prime prime here, and the sum is adding up to beta. So we have a thing here, and then we have another one here, and we're putting points in all possible positions on this one and this one, and we're looking for a coincidence. And at a coincidence, we can do the gluing operation, and that produces this piece here. So this, and so and the same thing here. So these two pieces here correspond to this term. See, these are other pieces of the Gromov chain in lower dimensions, which we're going to apply the operation to. So you have to perturb a lot to make sure everything is going to be transversal. And then this piece here is the delta term. This is the self-gluing term. So that's this term here. Well, so what? But anyway, that's the result. So in algebraic topology, there's this natural structure and this equivariant structure, so sort of string topology structure, you might say, which allows you to write an equation at the chain level. You don't get any solutions from string topology of this equation, but if you give the additional information of a symplectic structure, and in fact, you don't even give the symplectic structure, you give a deformation class of symplectic structures. Because if you move the symplectic structure continuously, this whole thing will move continuously. So homologically, it'll be equivalent to the one you have. So this is a invariant of a deformation class of symplectic structures, which is a solution of an equation where the operations make sense in the background. They don't use the symplectic structure to define them. Whereas the D-bar equation that defines the X-bar uses the, you know, the fact that you're symplectic to write it. So this is a sort of, in a way, a more primitive equation about the Gromov chain. So one can hope that it has some applications because it's part of the underlying structure behind the theory. That's all. Thank you. Are you going to shout? Yeah. I have no idea. I mean, I don't. I mean, there could be. Let's see. I hope that everything you can deduce about the Gromov-Witten theory in general can be deduced from this equation. That's just a hope, though. For example, the fact that there's this anomaly means the way you treat this homologically is going to be non-trivial. That's one thing. But there could be other solutions to this equation that correspond to other geometric structures. For like this is a background for what's called the A model. There's also the B model. And maybe there's a way to view that, isn't it? In fact, there is a way to view that, actually. When you actually look in Manning's book about the title of that book, Frobenius Manifolds, Quantum cohomology and moduli spaces. He's really talking about genus zero Gromov-Witten, so it's just the genus zero part where this anomaly isn't present. He's also talking about the generalized Kodaira-Spencer theory. See, I wanted to say this in the introduction, but you see, this idea that you have invariants that only depend on the deformation class of the complex structure means there are just countably many components. So it's sort of like algebraic topology. These are discrete invariants of the manifold. You've chosen a kind of complicated kind of orientation in order to define the invariants, but there are only countably many of them. It's sort of like when you have a topological four-manifold, you can choose a smooth structure. We don't understand at all what it means to choose a smooth structure on a topological four-manifold, but given it, you can now define the Donaldson and Seiberg-Witten invariants, which is in a way similar in form. And also, when you have a complex manifold, you can study not just it, but all of its deformations as a complex structure, the generalized Godowska-Spencer theory. And in some sense, if you look at sheaf cohomology and coefficients of the tangent bundle and all sorts of tensor products and so on, but you also deform all that, then that's really an invariant of the underlying differentiable manifold together with this choice of a component of the space of complex structures. So all of these things are kind of topological. They're discrete. And, you might hope that there is a version of this discussion that would include this example and maybe a different kind of version that would include this example. I mean, I don't know what are the possibilities, but this is the equation that in some very general discussions, this is the equation that they use to try to make a quantum field theory. And it's really just the more, this is just the equation d squared is zero, right? I mean, if these commuted, this would be the equation extended to the tensor algebra. So this is a version of the equation d squared is zero. So it's not an exotic equation. So every equation is that. Oh, yeah. I'm saying the equation makes sense for it. That was the whole point of the talk, right? Any manifold, you can write this structure in the equation, right?
So, there's this idea that, say, holomorphic maps should represent semi-infinite cycles in the space of all maps. Do you think that maybe there's like a...
But then you'd have to change the background discussion, right? You'd have to change what you mean by algebraic topology. Right, I'm doing good old down-home, old-fashioned algebraic topology. If you wanted, that'd be a new kind of algebraic topology.
Well, just consider
that equation. In where, though?
In whatever background manifold
you have. Oh, yeah, but you have to set up the equation. No, but you have to define these things. Well, this would probably be okay, right? That'd be whatever boundary operator you have, but you have to define this and you have to define this as operations in your theory. Oh, you're doing good old-fashioned algebraic topology. Okay. Okay. Oh, I see. You let X be the semi-something. So say what X is? Yeah.
Well, just look at those X's that satisfy that equation.
All right.
Maybe that's the model for semi-infinite homology of this
Oh, I see. These are the cycles of some. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That, as I say, the homological treatment of this, I haven't done it yet. I'm trying to do it. Yeah. But because they don't commute, the naive thing I was presenting in Stanford is only works. It works for the genus zero part. There's no term here, but this anomaly gets in the way, so it has to be, which is good news actually, because that was sort of too simple. I was uneasy about its simplicity. Okay.